Peter Walsh, on behalf of the appellee, W. Dexter Payne III. If I may, I simply like to introduce my co-counsel and lead counsel for Mr. Payne, Eric Goldstein of the Paul Weiss firm. And also seated at council table is Liza Valaquez of the same firm. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Pleasure to see you again. I rise to introduce my co-counsel in this matter, David Boies, Courtney Rocket, and Jared Reich of the Boies, Schiller & Flexner firm. And Mr. Boies has been admitted pro hac vice and will be making the argument on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome. And the court wants to begin by apologizing for the delay and expressing its appreciation for your having changed your schedule and then we made you wait. So I'm sorry about the way that all worked out, but we do appreciate it.
May it please the court. With the court's permission, I have reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves, as the court is aware, the interpretation of a settlement agreement that the court below and both parties here agree is unambiguous. There's a particular provision in that agreement that provides that any obligations with respect to what are called phantom capital and carried interests are due to former FPC, Fox Payne Company, executives, are going to be divided 50% paid by Fox, 50% by Payne. The initial question is, what does any obligations mean? And we believe that there are two critical concessions by counsel, the appellees, each of which is independently dispositive of this case. The first concession is that obligations means, as we think it must, legal obligations. As the court is aware, when we filed our initial brief, we interpreted the decision of the court below to read obligations more broadly than merely legal obligations because of the language in the court's opinion. However, in their brief, counsel for Payne has conceded that obligations must mean legal obligations. And if it means legal obligations, then there must be a trial to determine whether the alleged grants in this case are or are not legal obligations. We believe, as the briefs make clear, that that trial must be in arbitration because that's what the grant agreements provide and the employment agreements provide. But there must be a trial. And, of course, that did not happen below because the court simply assumed.
Sounds like you're mixing metaphors. You need a trial to determine if there's a legal obligation?
Well, Your Honor, you have some grants, alleged grants. And the question is, are those alleged grants a legal obligation or not?
Okay.
And the question is, how do you determine that?
Right.
And in this particular case, that ought to be determined by arbitration. But even if you were to conclude, contrary, we think, to the record below, that there was a basis for saying that somebody had waived the arbitration clause, there still would have necessarily had to have been a trial on the merits to determine whether these alleged grants are or are not actual, valid legal obligations.
Well, what's the disputed fact?
The disputed fact is that we dispute that those were legal obligations at any time. That is, that they were valid grants at all. They were grants that were issued in 2006.
Well, isn't something, whether it's a legal obligation, is a legal conclusion, isn't it?
It is ultimately a legal conclusion, but in order to reach the legal conclusion, you have to make a factual finding that it's valid, a grant existed, that a grant did exist, and that the grant wasn't forfeited. In this case, we would say that the grant did not exist because the February 2006 agreement, so-called NUCRO agreement, required that Fox and Payne, including Fox, approve of any grants in advance in writing. It is undisputed that that did not happen. Undisputed that did not happen. So under the terms of the documentation in existence, those grants were not valid. As the court is aware, there were
some. So why do you need a trial if it's undisputed that could not happen?
Well, Your Honor, we think we ought to get summary judgment on that issue. We think that the law is sufficient and the facts are sufficiently clear so that we actually should win this case in summary judgment. It was obviously decided against us. And at a minimum, what the court had to find was that there was a valid grant. Now, what the court did, I want to be fair to the court below, the court didn't purport to decide whether these were valid grants or not at the time they were issued. What the court said is that because the court concluded from extrinsic evidence that Mr. Fox was aware that people were claiming that these grants existed, that he would then interpret the settlement agreement when it says any obligations to include those grants that the court concluded based on extrinsic evidence Mr. Fox may have been aware of. And what the court said was this was designed to divorce the parties, solve all their disputes. The issue, however, is these disputes were not between Fox and Payne. These disputes, the dispute as to whether these are valid or invalid grants, whether they're actual legal obligations or not, is a dispute between executives who used to be with Fox Payne and then went to Payne. And that legal obligation to those people, if there is one, is what is in dispute here. And the settlement agreement provided how, quote, any obligations, which we all agree now means any legal obligations, would be divided, how they'd be paid. It does not address what those legal obligations are. It does not schedule them.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Isn't it reasonable to read a settlement agreement, the purpose of which is to resolve outstanding disputes, in a manner that actually resolves the disputes? If I understand your argument, you're saying, yes, we agree to a settlement, but now that we've got a settlement, we're going to have litigation over various elements of the payments that have to be made under this settlement. And nothing in the agreement says, after this settlement, now we'll litigate underlying or subsidiary claims relating to the settlement. So why should that be the way it's interpreted?
Well, you know, I think there are three answers to that. The first is that the grants that are involved here are grants that go to executives who are not parties to the settlement agreement.
Right.
The second thing is that settlement agreement really does address this in a way. It says that employees can enter into mutual releases with Fox Payne and with Fox if those are negotiated and are mutually acceptable. There's actually a provision that expressly deals with that in the settlement agreement. I think that's at 120 of the appendix. And it talks about how employee releases were contemplated, considered, but they were never executed. Agreement was never reached. In other words, there were certain things that were settled. There were certain things that there was a potential for settlement. But the settlement between Fox and Payne was not contingent on resolving any issues with respect to the executives. And those, it is undisputed again that no such releases were ever executed, even though there was a potential for them. So that they weren't parties to the agreement. There was an opportunity for a release that wasn't executed. The third thing, Your Honor, is that you can't define what is settled if you're talking about obligations without knowing what those obligations are. When it says any obligations, it clearly cannot mean any obligation that anybody comes into court and later claims. It can't be an open-ended thing.
But I thought, are you disputing the factual determination that that your client knew about these claims, at least? Maybe perhaps hadn't agreed that they were valid, but was aware of them.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. We are disputing that. As we've pointed out in our brief, what they have done in their extrinsic evidence is they have selected particular communications. What we did in our brief was we showed all the other extrinsic evidence that would demonstrate that the client was not aware that all these were being claimed. And that was made particularly unclear by the fact that they tried, as we've indicated in the briefs and we've demonstrated, and I don't think they dispute, Payne says, I didn't know anything about it, I didn't participate, but nobody disputes that Meyer and other people tampered with emails and tried to make it appear that these grants had taken place before February 2006. So we certainly dispute the fact that our client was aware of it, but even aware of particular claims. However, even if the court were to conclude, and that is a factual matter as to which we think there should have been a trial if you were going to rule as a matter of fact, and remember the court, because the court below concludes, as we've all agreed, that this is an unambiguous settlement agreement, the court says it's referencing the extrinsic evidence just to confirm. In other words, it wasn't factual findings in the sense that the court was making a determination on the merits. This was an unambiguous settlement agreement. And that means you've got to look at the four square corners of that settlement agreement. If this court concludes that all of us are wrong, and the court below was wrong, and that this is an ambiguous settlement agreement, then the court below would have had to approach the whole thing differently. But because it is conceded to be an unambiguous settlement agreement, you have a situation in which none of the parties, I think, to this court, would say that there's an ambiguity. You therefore must look to what's in the agreement. And the agreement doesn't schedule these, doesn't identify them, it just says any obligations. Now, they could have been scheduled. They could have been identified. I suppose in theory, it could even have said any claimed obligation or any obligation of which you have notice. As the court below indicated, these are sophisticated parties, good lawyers. They could have written that in. They didn't write it in. They just said any obligations, which means any obligations that are ultimately determined to be legal obligations. Remember, these were obligations not of Fox, not of Payne, but of Fox Payne Company, not to each other, but to the executives. And what they were saying is that when whatever obligations Fox Payne has to these executives, we'll split 50-50. But it wasn't purporting to determine what those obligations were. There's nothing in the settlement agreement that purports to determine what those obligations are.
Now, your side was offered the opportunity for an evidentiary hearing and declined it, is that right?
Well, Your Honor, the opportunity for the evidentiary hearing, as we point out in our reply brief, came before they submitted all of these affidavits and documents. We did have an opportunity to put in reply affidavits, but the opportunity for the hearing, the question about the hearing came first. But whether we, even if the request had come later, that is, even if the judge had said, well, in light of all this, we'll have another hearing, or you can offer another hearing, that would not, in our view, obviate the need for a factual determination on some record of this. And because of the arbitration clause, to the extent that the court needs to make that determination, we think the arbitration clause requires that be done by arbitration. This is not a situation in which you had a trial below as to whether or not these were or were not valid, outstanding legal obligations November of 2007, the month before the settlement agreement. Because what the court holds is the court interprets the settlement agreement as, in effect, obligating Mr. Fox to pay 50% of these obligations because he knew about the claims. Now, we think that's wrong, but we think even if he knew about the claims, that doesn't obligate him to pay them unless they're legal obligations. And I think that if you look at what has happened here, what's happened is that a settlement agreement was done between two parties. There were executives of those parties who were not parties to the settlement agreement, who had claims. They knew there would be some claims. And they had, and the parties agreed that whatever those claims ended up being, they split 50-50. But nothing in the settlement agreement addresses what those claims are, how much the claims are, which claims are valid and which claims are not valid. And what is happening here is that determination is being made without a trial, but more important, without arbitration, which is what the documents provide.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Eric Goldstein. We respectfully submit on behalf of the appellees that the decision of the Chancery Court below was fully supported by the law and the facts and should be affirmed. The applicable case law and how you interpret contracts is straightforward. You're supposed to affect the intent of the parties, but as this Court ruled in AT&T v. Lillis, the real test is to figure out not what the parties intended, but what a reasonable person in the position of the parties would have thought it meant. And in that regard, the context in which this settlement agreement was being entered into is critically important. The first issue is that Fox and Payne were involved in a huge, acrimonious, bitter dispute, business dispute. Among other things, Fox had accused Payne of raiding all of FPC's employees and terminating their employment at FPC and making them employees of Payne's new management company. The parties had engaged in extremely expedited and extensive litigation. The parties had submitted voluminous pretrial briefs to the Vice Chancellor, and then literally on the morning of trial, with Mr. Fox expected as the first witness, the parties settled the dispute. It is in that context that you need to look at the contract language itself. And Mr. Boies, in his presentation, entirely ignores the key sentence in the settlement agreement, which is the first sentence, which Mr. Boies skips to the second sentence. But the first sentence says, without qualification, without exception, that all carried interests, which the parties, Payne and Fox, agree mean the tracking interests as well, will vest immediately. All will vest immediately, and any escrow accounts will be paid out to them at closing. There's no reservation in that language. There's no suggestion that you need to only vest those grants that existed to which the parties had some predetermined litigation about validity. All grants vest. It then says, by the way, the rationale for doing this was clear. Fox had alleged in the litigation below that the employees had been terminated as FPC employees, that Payne had raided the employees, and they were now executives of a new entity. And as part of the settlement agreement, the parties were divvying up all of their business interests and obligations and putting an end to the dispute.
That included, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Fox ending up owning all the equity of Fox Payne and Mr. Payne ending up owning all of the equity of the new entity?
Roughly correct, Your Honor. There was some fund in Fox Payne that Mr. Payne took control of, but in terms of the management company itself, Mr. Payne gave up his interest in Fox Payne & Co. to Mr. Fox.
Resulting in Fox Payne being entirely controlled by Mr. Fox.
Yes. And that's why it was so critically important. The settlement agreement makes clear, it's page 3 of the term sheet, which, Your Honors, is in the record at A118, that as between FPC and FPM3, the new management company, that all current employees, other than a handful, would be employed by the new management company. So that created the critical question, what to do with the grants, the employee deferred grants, these tracking interests that have been granted to the employees who would no longer be working for Fox Paine, and as to which many of these grants hadn't yet vested. The parties made an affirmative, unequivocal, unqualified decision to grant, vest immediately any of those grants and pay those escrow amounts out at closing. Now, Mr. Boyce suggests that these were sort of in the ether. What were these grants? Undisputed that on November 30th, 2007, Mr. Fox's finance person received a list of what these grants were. And these grants were then the subject of an undisputed conversation between Fox's finance person and Payne's finance person on the night before the agreement was signed. And in that regard, the affidavit of Mr. Gersh, Mr. Fox's CFO, is particularly instructive. It's A732 through 735 of the record. And in that affidavit, at paragraph 5, Mr. Gersh says that, quote, in order for plaintiffs to effectively negotiate the settlement of the 2007 litigation, plaintiffs needed to determine what grants were outstanding in order to determine the value that Sawfax and Dexter Payne retained in Fund 1 and Fund 2, and what interests had been granted to the others. It then says, paragraph 6, that he receives this November 30th email listing the grants that are currently in dispute. This is 2 days before they sign the settlement agreement. And then, paragraph 8, they participate in a phone call with Mr. Payne's finance people in order to get a better understanding of the total amount and potential value of the grants that had been previously issued. Quote, in particular, the purpose of this phone call was to attempt to determine the overall value of Fund 2 and what interests had been granted to the then former FPC employees. And then goes on to say that as a result of that call, paragraph 9, Mr. Teal, another of Mr. Fox's employees, and I believed that we had a rough idea of the maximum exposure to these grants and therefore knew what grants were going to be expected to vest, unqualified, absolute, in that first sentence of the agreement. And it was in that context that Mr. Fox and Mr. Payne entered into this settlement agreement. Now, Mr. Fox now seeks to invalidate these grants, even though there's no language saying that all grants that have been previously determined to be valid in arbitration or otherwise vest. It says all vest. And what's particularly ironic about what Mr. Fox is attempting here is that Mr. Fox's basis for seeking to invalidate these grants is at the time they were entered into and at the time of the settlement, these employees were no longer employees of Fox, Payne & Co., and therefore there could be no possible basis to allow for a valid grant. The problem with that is Mr. Fox knew that absolutely at the time of the settlement agreement. A critical issue in the underlying litigation was whether the employees had been rated and terminated, with Mr. Fox taking the position that they had been terminated and were no longer employees, and Mr. Payne saying, look, they switched payroll to the new management company because that's what the parties had decided, but they continued to work for both. So Mr. Fox and his finance staff knew the day before they entered into this language precisely which grants were intended to be vested in an unqualified way, and they knew precisely that the claimed invalidity now, that these employees, according to Mr. Fox, were no longer employees of FPC, and therefore the grants were valid ab initio, before they were even implemented.
Counsel, Mr. Boyce tells us that whether or not Mr. Fox knew the grants that are now in dispute is itself a disputed fact. Does the record show a dispute?
I believe not, Your Honor. If you look at the Gersh affidavit from Mr. Fox's own finance person says that they had an understanding of what grants were being granted and to what language this contract provision would apply. That's, again, A732 to 735. Similarly, the November 30th, 2007 email from Mr. Meyer, who worked for Mr. Payne, to Mr. Gersh, which appears in the appendix at A141, states very clearly, tracking interest grants, that is the subject heading of this November 30th email, 2 days before they actually signed the agreement, and it lists all of the grants and the identities of the individuals who, at the time this email was sent, Mr. Fox was saying we're no longer employees of FPC, and therefore any grants would have been void ab initio, and yet he turns around and puts in language that says all carried interests will vest immediately and any escrow accounts will be paid out to them at closing. Coming then to the next sentence. This was FPC's obligation, but since, as you mentioned, Your Honor, the FPC, Mr. Payne, was giving up his interest entirely, Mr. Fox bargained for the fact that that he would not have to assume the obligation for these vested grants all by himself. So he said, Mr. Payne, I want you to be responsible for 50% of them, even though you no longer have any interest in FPC. And as part of the bargain for exchange of vesting all of these grants and then having the obligation split between the two of them, that's exactly what happened. It says that Mr. Payne and Mr. Fox will split 50-50 the obligations that they'd assumed in agreeing to vest immediately. And to be clear, there's no question, as the Vice Chancellor found, that that the parties had modified by this settlement agreement in a significant way the language of the underlying grants. The underlying grants provided for vesting into the end of 2008. They were vesting as of the end of 2007. The underlying grants had specific provisions about when escrows could be paid out once there had been vesting. Now they were saying they vested immediately, they were paid out, immediately at closing. So as the court below correctly found, and this is a quote from its opinion, it's clear from the unambiguous language of the settlement agreement that the parties intended to change the nature of the grants and FPC's obligations thereunder in several important ways that plainly acknowledges their validity. And that's the key. In saying that in an unqualified, without reservation way, that all of the grants vest immediately and all of the escrow accounts get paid out immediately at closing, the parties were changing the underlying grant provisions and saying at that point that it was Mr. Fox and Mr. Payne's equal responsibility to pay for those grants. Now,
is it critical to your position whether or not Mr. Fox knew or had any basis for knowing before the settlement agreement was signed about the existence of these disputed grants?
The answer, Your Honor, is no. I believe he did know. I think the undisputed background facts, which a court can look to under Eagle and SI in interpreting a contract, there's no question that these are undisputed facts. And in fact, the parties entered into a stipulation of authenticity in this case. The record of that stipulation.
My question is whether the fact is disputed or undisputed. Is it material to your position?
No, Your Honor, but I think the language of the contract as understood by any reasonable person.
Because of the universality of the language.
Of the first sentence.
But you go on and argue that, in fact, as a matter of undisputed fact, Mr. Fox did know.
Exactly.
And that although his counsel argues that that is a disputed fact, there's no basis in the record to find that there is a dispute.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, Mr. Fox's reading of the contract does vast damage to its provisions. It makes the immediate vesting and escrow payout provisions entirely illusory. Was in fact, what Mr. Fox disputes here is not some small portion of the tracking interest at stake. Mr. Fox, and I'll give you the record side, seeks to invalidate every single 100% of the tracking carry grants. There is not a single tracking carry grant that Mr. Fox does not now contend is invalid, having nevertheless agreed to vest all grants as of the time of the settlement agreement. He also, that's the carry phantom grants. Turning to the total phantom interest grants, he seeks to invalidate essentially 96%+ of them. And the lest there be any question about that, the Mr. Fox's affidavit in this case contains an exhibit A and B, and it lists the disputed grants and the undisputed grants, and under the undisputed grants it lists non-tracking grants, and in the disputed grants is all of the tracking interest grants. So he's not simply saying at the edges, I'm seeking to invalidate notwithstanding this unqualified language. I'm seeking to invalidate it all, which does terrible justice. And what does the word immediately vest mean? If it doesn't mean immediately vest, you can come back and simply a challenge. And in that regard, Black's Law Dictionary defines vesting to mean having become a completed, consummated right for present or future enjoyment, not contingent, unconditional, absolute. And that's exactly what the parties were trying to do, and for good reason.
A hypothetical question. What if an employee showed up with a claim that neither party thought was valid, that wasn't on any prior list, but comes in and says, hey, you know, you agreed to pay it, here it is, pay me.
Is this, just to clarify, Your Honor, is this an existing deferred grant, a compensation grant that had been provided?
Somebody makes one up, yeah.
If someone makes one up?
Yeah.
Look, Your Honor, my answer to that question is Mr. Fox and Mr. Payne clearly understood the framework of what was going to be granted, which is that November 30th email listing them. And so it's a hypothetical that doesn't exist in the context of this case. They agreed to grant, to give immediate vesting to all then existing grants. If it was a then existing grant, it was given immediate effect. Now, the court then, to Your Honor's point earlier, then secondarily confirms. Vice Chancellor Lamb makes very clear that he does not rely on extrinsic evidence in deciding the plain meaning of this contract. He says, given the context, it was clear that the parties were seeking to resolve these disputes and that the basis for invalidity here is the very subject that was at the crux of the underlying dispute, the nature of the employee status, whether they were FPC or not. But then he says beyond that, to secondarily confirm his finding, he then marshals the evidence that has been provided, looks to the stipulation of authenticity by the parties, which stipulate to the authenticity of all of the emails, and says it confirms clearly my reading of this unambiguous contract. As to that secondary confirmation, We respectfully submit that this court should give great deference to that finding, because it's essentially resolving factual matters consistent with this court's ruling in many cases, and should only upset that ruling if it's clearly erroneous, which we believe it clearly is not. Finally, I have very little time. A word about attorney's fees.
Well, before you address that, the other side says there should have been a trial. Why not?
Well, Your Honor, if the contract is unambiguous on its face, as both parties contend that it was, then the whole notion of trial is unnecessary, because the court should be able to interpret the contract unambiguously. Second, the court, undisputed, allowed the party the opportunity for live testimony. Then again, at a time when the Mr. Fox, can I?
You can finish your answer.
Thank you. At a time when Mr. Fox had not yet seen Mr. Payne's reply, Mr. Fox's counsel reserved the right, upon seeing that reply, to seek live testimony. Didn't take itself up on that opportunity. And then after it submitted its surreply affidavits and exhibits, many surreply affidavits and exhibits, the court said we could then decide whether an evidentiary hearing was appropriate, and Mr. Fox never took the court up on that offer either. So there was adequate opportunity for that, even if it were necessary, but given the party's posture that this was an unambiguous contract, there would have been no need for such a trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I believe Mr. Goldstein may have inadvertently misspoke. I don't think after all the stuff was submitted, the judge said we could select a evidentiary hearing. The court said the court would decide whether to have an evidentiary hearing. And I think you just need to look at the record to decide whether my recollection or his recollection is right on that. Mr. Goldstein says that you need to give deference to factual findings. And yet, at the other hand, he says this is an unambiguous contract interpreted as a matter of law. It can't be both. It is an unambiguous contract interpreted as a matter of law. Therefore, there are no factual findings, and therefore there's no deference to those factual findings. If you go to the extrinsic evidence, I ask the court, please, take a look at the extrinsic evidence that is being cited here. Counsel quotes from the Gersh affidavit. That's page 734 of the record. And he quotes the first sentence of a paragraph. He doesn't quote the second sentence, which says, however, I believe it was clear to all participants of the telephone call that both Mr. Teal and I remained confused about the alleged grants and did not fully understand all aspects of and could not possibly have fully understood the various grants from that call. That's the call that followed the November 30 email. The November 30 email is at 94, Appendix B. It does not attach the grants. It does not tell you when the grants were established. The whole issue here was did the grants precede February of 06 or did they come after February 06? Before February of 06, Mr. Payne could have done it on his own. After February 06, he required the advance written approval of Mr. Fox, which never happened. And this email lists grants that are claimed but doesn't specify when they were issued. That's the critical item. It doesn't attach them. And then there's the later telephone call that Mr. Gersh reports on, that they rely on, and Mr. Gersh says, I couldn't tell about the alleged grants. Now, that's the state of the extrinsic evidence. We don't think you ought to get into the extrinsic evidence at all. But if you do, please look at the extrinsic evidence that both sides have cited, because that is where, if you were down in the weeds down there, that's where the dispute is. But the key thing is that this, you should not be in there at all. We ought to be looking at the actual language. And counsel says that it's the universality of the first sentence. All carried interests of employees will immediately vest. He says that's meaningless if you're disputing what we're talking about. But the carried interests include both actual interests and phantom interests, both actual and phantom. The part we're talking about, any obligations with respect to phantom capital and carried interests, only refer to the phantom interests. So there's a whole category of the actual interests that are covered by that first sentence that are not even addressed in the second sentence. In addition, the second sentence talks about both capital and carried interests, both capital and carried interests. As we point out in the brief, there's capital interest, there's carried interest, there's phantom interest, and there's actual interest. Put those two different categories together, you've got four different types of interest. The first paragraph, the first sentence, is talking about all carried interests, both capital and phantom. The second one is talking about phantom capital and carried interests. So those are two, they're addressing different things. And you've got to understand that, to understand the context of what's going on. But that comes from the context of the actual language here. There's nothing here that talks about what is a valid actual grant or not. It would have been very easy for these sophisticated parties to have listed these grants. If they could put them in an email, they could have put them on a schedule to this agreement. They didn't do it. And the reason they didn't do it is because they weren't addressing the validity of these grants at that time. Nothing in the settlement negotiations suggests that anybody addressed the validity of those grants. Nothing in the settlement agreement. Nothing in the settlement negotiations. Yes, people had a rough idea of what the claims were, but that's not a basis for determining what's valid and what's invalid. They clearly understood that they were dividing up their interests, but they never addressed what the legal obligations were. And Your Honor is exactly right. Somebody could come up and make something up, and that's exactly what happened here. People made things up after the fact. They tried to backdate these things before 2006. They misrepresented when they were, and when they were found out and when they were challenged, that's when this dispute arose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court appreciates the argument. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.